Hello, this is Bob Kruger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Thought for Food for August 2010. While we may be dissatisfied with all this extremely hot weather, it's also a time of harvest for many fruits and vegetables. There's still blueberries available. We're in the midst of the season for locally grown peaches, cantaloupes, and watermelons. Field peas, bell peppers, squash, eggplant, okra, corn, and butter beans are available now. If you want good, reasonably priced fresh produce, find a local farmer's market and enjoy some good eating. As we travel, we often find interesting places to eat that offer very delicious food. It can often be very healthful. On the other side of the coin are interesting-sounding menus that are loaded with calories. Most road foods won't win any healthy eating awards, but some regional fare is so fattening it could take your diet on a complete detour. The editors of Health.com researched regional high-calorie, high-fat foods and named one high-calorie nutritional bombshell from each state. The staff searched for information from regional food bloggers and restaurants and got contributions from Twitters and Facebook followers. We did a lot of research, but we didn't set strict guidelines on how many fat grams or calories a food had to have to make the list of the fattest foods, says the website's editor-in-chief, Amy O'Connor. The winners in each state were based on the grossness factor and shocking combination, she said. And here are some of the winners. In Georgia, you can get what is called a Luther burger, supposedly named after singer Luther Vandross. It's a ground beef patty topped with bacon and cheese, sandwiched between two Krispy Kreme donuts instead of a bun. In Iowa, there's a hot beef sundae, which has made its debut at the Iowa State Fair a few years ago. It's mashed potatoes, roast beef, beef gravy, cheddar cheese, and a little cherry tomato on top to look like a cherry on a sundae. In Vermont, there's Ben & Jerry's Vermonster, which includes 20 scoops of ice cream, hot fudge, bananas, cookies, brownies, and any other topping you can possibly want. Nearby in Connecticut, diners at Doogie's can get a 2-foot-long hot dog on a roll with onions, chili, cheese, and bacon, and a side order of fries. In Colorado, the Jack and Grill has a 7-pound breakfast burrito. It's made with 7 potatoes, a dozen eggs, a pound of ham, and a whole onion, plus cheese and chili. In New Mexico, recipes for a Frito pie vary, but most include Frito's corn chips, beef, beans, onions, cheddar cheese, lettuce, and tomato. In other western states, menus offer items like Arizona's Heart Attack Grill, which offers what they call the quadruple bypass burger, with 4 beef patties, 8 slices of cheese, tomato, onion, and sauce on a bun. In Nevada, the all-you-can-eat buffets, so popular in casinos, especially, are not a good place to stop for people who are weight conscious. I wish I knew who rated highest in North Carolina. Many of these foods are delicious, O'Connor says, but they contain more fat and calories than you need for an entire day. You don't get to go out and take a road trip to try them, she says. Maybe next year we will. In another health-related study, we find that women who want to prevent weight gain as they age should hop on a bike or take a brisk walk, a new study finds. The findings added to mounting evidence of importance of moderate to vigorous exercise for weight control. Researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health and Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston analyzed data on more than 18,000 premenopausal women in the Nurses' Health Study, an ongoing research project that began in 1989. The women completed questionnaires on their medical, exercise, and living habits. According to findings from the study, reported in a recent issue of Archives of Internal Medicine, the women overall gained an average of 20.5 pounds over 16 years, but those who regularly biked or walked briskly were less likely to gain as much. This research shows that both brisk walking and biking can help prevent weight gain, said Ann Lusk, a research fellow at the Harvard School of Public Health. But slow walking doesn't keep weight in check, she said. Women need to step it up or bike, which may be more comfortable for them, she says. Other research shows that men benefit from these types of exercise, Ms. Lusk says. Ann McTierman, the director of the Prevention Center at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, has shown in her research that women who do exercise, such as walking or biking, for 2 to 5 hours a week during weight loss efforts lose an extra 3 to 5 pounds over a year. A July 5th report from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends the routine screening for osteoporosis should include all younger postmenopausal women who have at least the same chance of a bone break as an older woman. Also, for the first time, the group weighed whether men should be checked for this bone-thinning disease, but decided it hadn't enough evidence to recommend for or against the screening. The U.S. Prevention Services Task Force draft guidelines widened its 2002 advice when it first said that all women over 65 plus those 60 to 64 at a higher risk for fractures should get a bone density test. The task force now says that all younger postmenopausal women should get checked if their risk of a broken bone is the same or greater than the average 65-year-old woman. Factors that can increase the risk include low weight, certain drugs, smoking, heavy alcohol use, and a patient who has a broken hip. Majority of the evidence supports screening and treatment of osteoporosis in postmenopausal women, the task force wrote. The evidence for primary prevention in men is lacking and future research is needed. In a break from previous practice, the independent government-appointed panel posted a draft of guidelines online to allow for public comment. The task force has been considering this move, but reaction to its controversial mammogram guidelines last fall spurred the group to open the process earlier, said Dr. Ned Colones, head of the panel. The task force used a web-based risk calculator called FRAX, F-R-A-X, that estimates one odds of a fracture within 10 years. It shows women as young as 50 may meet the threshold for a bone test, depending on their risk factors, the panel said. A bone mineral density X-ray is the most frequently used test for bone loss, and many women start getting scans once they reach menopause. Osteoporosis weakens bones and leads to painful and crippling fractures, primarily in the hip, spine, and wrist. In women, it's mostly caused by a drop in bone-strengthening estrogen after menopause. The government estimates that 10 million Americans have the disease, and half of all women will suffer an osteoporosis bone break in their lifetime. North Carolina waddles up on the fat list is the headline of a news story that appeared on the last day of June. It reads, here's a ranking no one aspires to. North Carolina is ranked 10th in the nation for our large population of people who are obese or overweight. That's worse than last year when we were number 12, according to the annual report released by the advocacy group Trust for American Health. This gives us more resolve to dig in our heels and try to get everyone involved, said Brooke Findlay, the Healthy Weight Communications Specialist in the North Carolina Division of Public Health, which announced grants to 20 programs statewide aimed at cutting the obesity rates. And here are some of the headlights or lowlights, more appropriately, of this year's F as in Fat report. 29% of the people of North Carolina are obese, defined as having a body mass index of 30 or more. 36% are overweight. All but one of the 10 fattest states are in the South, with Michigan the exception. It tied with us at 10th. Nearly 19% of North Carolina children are obese, ranking 11th nationally. Despite concentrated efforts to battle the bulge, obesity rates rose in North Carolina and 27 other states. Obesity is more prevalent among poor people, blacks, Hispanic, and women. Obesity causes or contributes to at least 20 diseases, chief among them diabetes and cardiovascular disease. Gloomy numbers aside, the report's authors noted signs of progress. Many states, including North Carolina, are starting programs in schools, churches, and communities that promote exercise and healthy diets. One way to beat the heat this summer, stay hydrated. There's more than one way to do it. The quickest way is to drink what you need. The old advice to drink 8 glasses of water isn't completely accurate. You may need more or less depending on your diet, the temperatures you're exposed to, and your activity level. When you are physically active outdoors on a hot day, for example, you need more fluid than when you are working in days on a cooler day. What's best to drink? Simple, water. Why? Because it contains zero calories and is free from many additives, caffeine, artificial flavorings and colorants, and sweeteners that diminish the wholesomeness or, in the case of caffeine, may contribute to other problems such as sleep disturbances or a rapid heartbeat. Any kind of water is fine. Tap water, seltzer water, club soda. Don't bother with designed bottled waters containing added vitamins, minerals, or oxygen. They're expensive and they don't live up to the benefits they claim. If you're working out in the heat, start drinking water before you're thirsty. We're told that by the time you're actually thirsty, your body is beginning to be affected by the lack of water. Other kinds of fluids count too. Among your choices are coffee and tea. Yes, there are a few caveats. It's just fine to drink those regularly. Avoid sweet tea and choose decaffeinated coffee and tea if you have difficulties tolerating caffeine. Concerns about the dehydrating effects of caffeine are overblown. The water in these beverages may more than compensate for a little loss of fluid caused by caffeine. Soft drinks. I'm not a fan because they're filled with artificial everything. However, if you must, choose the sugar-free varieties. The upside is they do provide a fluid source at a time when you may need one. Fruit juices are another fluid source. They are high in calories, so dilute them with seltzer water instead of drinking them straight. There's some evidence the so-called sports drinks may benefit elite athletes, but that's not most of us. So use them sparingly. I've been attending some summer basketball games played by 11 to 13-year-olds, and a good number of these boys use the sports drinks. Save them for times when hydration is your top priority. Like many fruit drinks, sports drinks contain added sugar that you're better off without. You may be surprised to learn that beverages aren't the only source of fluid in your diet. In fact, fresh fruits and vegetables can satisfy up to half of your fluid needs. The best choices are also rich in vitamins, minerals, and fibers. And they include all of the summer favorites, melons, tomatoes, cucumbers, bell peppers, summer squash, blueberries, strawberries, and grapes. Cooking draws fluids out of food, so eat them fresh for maximum hydration benefits. Have you heard of a cold soup made by processing cantaloupe with a plain or vanilla yogurt and enough orange juice to achieve the right consistency? Add a dash of cinnamon as a garnish. Staying healthy by making enough fluid in your diet during these extra warm days. These suggestions came from a column by Suzanne Havala Hobbs, whom I've quoted many times before. As Krispy Kreme opened its new Wake Forest store recently, officials were already laying plans for Triangle expansion. The next store will open in Chapel Hill by early September, says Stephen Weimer, Krispy Kreme's marketing manager for North Carolina. That spot is 157 Franklin Street, formerly occupied by Firehouse Subs. That will be the Winston-Salem donut chain's fourth new Triangle location in just over a year. It follows a year when the Triangle Company had a single location in this region on Person Street in Raleigh. That store recently reopened after extensive renovations. For fans of the glazed, gooey, sugary concoctions, the expansion means more choices. For Krispy Kreme, it's aimed at winning new customers and protecting its turf as rivals like Dunkin' Donuts push into this region. We've got a very big Krispy Kreme following in this area, Weimer said. He added there's no target number of stores for the Triangle, but made it clear more are coming. Our CEO, Jim Morgan, is really determined to make Krispy Kreme available to as many people as he can, he said. We don't want to put stores right on top of each other, but we want to make it convenient for people. Part of the key to Krispy Kreme's recent expansion is a new strategy tied to a smaller store model. At roughly 1,700 to 2,000 square feet, none of the new stores bake the donuts on site. The original Person Street store in Raleigh is the only local factory store where customers can watch the donuts being made. It supplies all area stores, including the one planned for Chapel Hill, with donuts. This strategy means less investment and less time to open new stores, which is key, Weimer said. The two stores in Wake Forest and Chapel Hill will have hot now lights because the donuts will be trucked in from the Person Street store but glazed on site. The extension is part of a broader plan to boost sales hurt by the recession and a growing trend toward consumers eating more healthful foods. The company is also expanding internationally and adding products such as specialty drinks and a soft-serve ice cream. I think they sense they're not the only players in the market anymore. Bob Golden, the executive vice president for Technomic, a Chicago-based firm that tracks the food industry, it's forcing them to be better competitors. The changed growth follows a long period of problems at the corporation, including a accounting fraud scandal and other management problems. Krispy Kreme stock became a Wall Street darling a decade ago, reaching $50 a share in 2003, but fell out of favor. It now trades at about $3.50 a share. Company officials aren't worried about opening too many stores or expanding too fast. We do some marketing surveys, and we try to find out where a lot of our customers at Person Street do live, and we try to target those areas as much as we can, Weimer said. We get a lot of requests from different communities wanting us to come in, he said. I don't think oversaturation is an issue at this point, nor is the company concerned at this point about exceeding the production capabilities of the Person Street store, he said. If we can find other locations we still want to expand, there's no reason we can't build another producing facility, Weimer said. We all know that Smithfield Foods is the largest pork producer in the country. Rumors are going around they may be taken over by a Brazilian company called JBS SA. JBS is the world's largest meat packer and in 2008 purchased Smithfield's beef group division. A spokeswoman for Smithfield declined to comment on a rumor that was reported in a Brazilian newspaper, though no source was named. The newspaper reported that JBS had no comment. Any deal would have repercussions in North Carolina, where Smithfield has 10,000 employees at various facilities, as well as contracts with hog farmers across the state. About half of the company's North Carolina employees work at a plant in Tar Heel, about 80 miles south of Raleigh. It's the largest pork-producing plant in the world. Smithfield has locations in Clinton, Kinston, and Wilson, and many of the company's other divisions, including Stefano Foods, Butterball, and Murphy Brown, have other locations throughout the state. The rumors of a talk follow a few rough years for Smithfield. The company lost $190.3 million in its fiscal 2009 year, as was hurt by both the recession and people's worries about swine flu. This year, Smithfield reported a $101.4 million loss for fiscal 2010. A deal between JBS and Smithfield would make sense, said Jack Plunkett, a Houston analyst who follows the food industry. JBS has been expanding aggressively for the past few years, Plunkett said, buying other popular American brands such as Pilgrim's Pride, which had entered bankruptcy before being acquired. JBS has a good reputation in the meat industry and is a corporate leader in Brazil, Plunkett said. The meatpacking industry generally has low profit margins, and there have been more challenges in recent years for companies like Smithfield, Plunkett added. Even the most successful companies generally have profit margins of 3 or 4%, he said. You're very subject to swings in food, commodity prices, transportation costs. It's just a tough business. At JBS, we're looking at a $18 billion annual revenue company that's making good profits and more than doubled in size from 2007 to 2009, so they must be doing something right, Plunkett said. It's hard to say yet what a JBS acquisition could mean for Smithfield's more than 52,000 global employees, said. Analysts could look at cases in which JBS took over a large U.S. operation. In the case of Pilgrim's Pride, a poultry processing company, the company's operation were moved in early 2009 to the JBS U.S. headquarters in Greeley, Colorado, a move that eliminated 230 corporate jobs. 5 months later, the company announced it would hire up to 1,400 people and invest $30 million to reopen a plant in Georgia. Any deal would likely affect employees of all of Smithfield's division, including Butterball, which moved its headquarters to Garner in 2009. Smithfield has been moving to streamline its operation, reeling off to sell out its partner in Butterball, Maxwell Farms of Goldsboro. Smithfield owns 49% of Butterball, and Maxwell owns the other 51%. If Maxwell doesn't agree by fall, Smithfield says it will sell its share of the company. Butterball CEO Keith Shoemaker said he had no knowledge of any deals and he had no update on negotiations between Smithfield and Maxwell Farms. Personally, I would hate to see another American company taken over by a foreign company. From time to time, I share with you letters and questions that have been sent to food editors. Question: I love to bake, but a lot of recipes call for more sugar than I would prefer. Is it possible to cut down sugar in baking? And here's the answer. Reducing in sugar in baked goods isn't as easy as reducing fat. You can use such things as fruit purees to reduce fat, but sugar contributes more than sweetness. It also contributes bulk, helps tenderness and texture, and affects browning. Splenda does make a product for baking, so you could try that. In most baking recipes, particularly cookies, quick breads, or muffins, you can remove a quarter of the total amount of either granulated or brown sugar. If the recipe calls for 1 cup of sugar, try using 3/4 of a cup. The final result will be less sweet and may not brown as much. You will have to try to see whether you like it or not. In regards to baking, another question. In a recent question on cooking times, you noted that batter in a 13-by-9-inch pan generally bakes in less time than the same amount of batter spread in 2 9-inch cake pans. Is this a mistake? Shouldn't a larger pan take longer to bake? And the answer, you would think so, wouldn't you? But there's more to play than just pan size. For one, there's the depth of the batter. If the batter usually fits into 2 9-inch cake pans and you put it in a 13-by-9 pan, the batter in the two pans would be about the same depth, about 2 inches. But what if the batter usually fit well into 2 8-inch cake pans, another common size? In a 13-inch pan, the batter wouldn't be as deep and the baking time wouldn't be as long. There's also the issue of surface area. Batter spread over a wider surface area may actually bake a little faster because more of it is exposed to direct heat in the oven. Note the word may, though. There's no hard and fast rules on adjusting time when you change pan sizes. There are many variables, including the kind of pan, metal, glass, or nonstick, and how heavy it is. In my recommendation, I erred on the side of caution and suggest starting to check the cake a little earlier. It might bake in the same amount of time as the 9-inch pans, but also might take a little more or less time. The only way to know for sure is to use your eyes, your nose, and your judgment for signs that it's done. I recently found an article about my favorite dried bean that I want to share with you. I don't believe that I'd ever eaten pinto beans before I came to North Carolina. My dad grew a golden navy bean in his garden, and we had plenty of them. But today, all of the varieties of dried beans available, the pinto is my favorite. I'm not sure I can give you a reason. I just like them and fix a pot of them about once a month. I usually prepare 2 pounds or more at a time, served with chopped raw onion and cornbread. You have a great meal. I often then prepare chili using part of the beans I had cooked. Just add about 1 pound of cooked ground beef drained of the grease, a package of chili mix, canned tomatoes, and another great meal is ready. The story begins. Pinto beans are neglected by many cooks. Black beans have a Southwest vibe, lentils that Asian allure, even black-eyed peas go gourmet Southern. But pintos is hard to place them. Pintos can star in a number of dishes. Traditional Mexican refried beans use pintos, and beans are often called red Mexican beans. They can extend or stand in for meat in chilies. Like all beans, pintos are economical protein sources. Dried pintos should be soaked for 8 hours or overnight in cold water before cooking. To save time later, soak and cook a lot of pintos, then package them in airtight containers and freeze them. They will keep in the freezer for up to 6 months. Be sure to date the containers. Canned pintos are a quick alternative to dried and still inexpensive. It's recommended if you use the canned ones, it's a good idea to rinse them to remove most of the salt. But you don't have this problem if you use the dried ones. Many cook pintos the old-fashioned way with a big chunk of some sort of fat meat. I like to use a ham bone for flavor, from which I remove all the fat I can. I add no salt. The ham bone often provides all the salt needed. Andrea Weigel, the food editor for the News and Observer, often writes profiles of people who produce and market products at local farmers' markets. And one story had the headline, "Honey, I've Got a New Harbor." Hobby, and this is the story. Al Hildreth waited a year to tell his wife about what he hoped would be his new hobby, beekeeping. Thank goodness his wife shared his interest. Now the couple have 16 hives of bees on their Johnson County properties. They have a honey and bee business, Shamrock's Busy Bee, and sell Saturday at the Clayton Farmers and Community Market. This gives us time to be together to do something we both like, Kathy Hildreth said. Al Hildreth, 46, who works as a contract programmer in the Research Triangle Park, had no experience with bees when he decided to take a beekeeping class in 2008. He said he became fascinated with how each bee has duties from nursing to guarding to foraging. Kathy Hildreth, 45, said she was fascinated on how bees secrete wax via glands in their chest. That was like, wow. 2 years ago, Kathy, who does administrative work for the town of Clayton, heard about the new farmers market. This couple decided to sign up as vendors, and slowly their products have grown from honey to soap, candles, lip balm, and candy. The couple divide their bee duties. Al dons the bee suit to manage the hives. Kathy helps bottle the honey and make soap and candles. So the obvious question to any beekeeper, do you get stung a lot? This year, about 4 or 5 times, was all my fault, Al Hildreth said. A lesson for wannabe beekeepers. Don't use your bare hands to pull weeds from under a beehive. North Carolina Cracker meet Pennsylvania Pretzels. Charlotte Lance, the maker of sandwich crackers, ubiquitous to convenience stores, on July 22nd, signed a merger with Snyder's of Hanover, the iconic pretzel maker. The union will form Snyder's Lance, which will keep its headquarters in Charlotte. The companies hope that by joining forces, they'll be able to increase their sales and cut costs. Snyder's Lance will benefit from a wide selection of snack food choices and national distribution, said David Singer, a president and CEO of Lance. Singer will become the CEO of the combined company. The deal, which needs shareholder and regulatory approval, is expected to close in the fall. Lance, founded in 1913, also makes Cape Cod potato chips, Archway cookies, and other products. Privately owned Snyder's, which also makes tortilla chips and nuts, traces its roots to 1909. Often we hear of a new product introduced by a coupon on a Sunday newspaper. Have you heard of Sun Crystals? We're aware of and perhaps have used sugar substitutes like Sweet and Low, Splenda, and others. Their ad claims that Sun Crystals are a 100% combination of pure cane sugars baking perfection and stevia leaf extracts low-calorie sweetness. They also claim to be a proud sponsor of the American Diabetes Association. This is a season of the year when it's a good idea to go through some recipe books, we all have them, and try to find a new method of preparing an appetizing, cool meal. And I wish for you a successful and happy hunting through those cookbooks. Until next month, this has been Bob Krueger with Thought for Food. And it looks like we're going to run out of time with today's Thought for Food. And the content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And it's available as a podcast after the broadcast. And so we want to just say thank you for being with us, and we'll see you in about a month.